sex in my pants. Watch insects make a mess. Insects make me want to dance. Dance, they make me wanna dance. Dance, those insects make me want to. Flying insects everywhere. Flying insects buzzing, buzzing, buzzing through the air. Just like little diamonds in the sky. Insects buzzing in my eye. Buzzing insects make me want to dance. Dance, they make me wanna
And that was Insects by none other than Danny Elfman and Oingo Boingo from their farewell Halloween concert in 1995. And this is Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast episode number 125. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. This episode is an interview with Daniela Martin titled Entomophagy, Not Eating Insects is Dumb, and is being released on Monday, October 17, 2011. My interview with Daniela was recorded on October 12, 2011. Daniela Martin is the host of Girl Meets Bug, the insect cooking show where the unusual is the inevitable and oh-so-edible. She's passionate about teaching people that insects are fabulous food in addition to being the most environmentally efficient animal protein source on the planet. Her dream is to increase public awareness and acceptance of edible insects, with the ultimate goals of helping to solve world hunger, supporting indigenous culture, and reducing pesticide use with this cheap, eco-friendly source of protein. She has a BA in medical anthropology with a focus on pre-Columbian nutrition, followed by 2 years of pre-med. And upcoming shows, it looks like we're going to have Steven Zarlinga back, the author of The Lost Science of Money, to discuss the occupation of Wall Street, as well as the introduction of his bill into Congress recently by Dennis Kucinich. And I'm not sure who we'll have on after that, so we'll have to figure that out as time passes. Donations. This episode is dedicated to Corey, Paul, Ashley, and Duffy, Kim, Carlos, Arthur, and Scott. This show is run on donations and our website sales. This is not corporate media, but independent media in the truest sense of the words. And by donating or ordering one of the books or DVDs or the She Who Remembers audio archives, a t-shirt, or getting a membership to the website to download the older podcasts, you help to continue this programming. And of course, we greatly appreciate your support. And we ask that you stop sending your money every month to your cable company, paying the corporate media to lie to you every day, and instead, please support independent media like this, and not just here at Gnostic Media, but all quality independent media. The views expressed by the authors and guests of this unprogram are their own and are not necessarily those held by myself, the host, or Gnostic Media. You can check out the website at www.gnosticmedia.com. That's G-N-O-S-T-I-C. media.com. You can contact me through the contact form on the website or directly at contact@gnosticmedia.com. Thank you for listening and thank you for your support. And here is my very interesting and buggy interview with Daniela Martin. Enjoy. Daniela, welcome to the Gnostic Media Podcast.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
And I'm really excited to have you on to discuss this very interesting topic. It's very different from anything that we've ever discussed on this show before, and I figured it was politically incorrect enough to still merit a presentation. So I think you're right up there in the extremes as far as politically incorrectness goes. So why don't you start off by telling us a little bit about yourself, and we'll go from there.
Well, I am 34 years old. I live in Northern California, about a half an hour south of San Francisco, and I am trying to convince more people in the Western world to eat insects.
Now, you have a background in anthropology, don't you?
I do. I studied medical anthropology. I studied cultural approaches to both nutrition and medicine with a focus on pre-Columbian nutrition and medicine in the Yucatan of Mexico. Primarily what I wanted to know during my undergraduate research was what vestiges of early traditional native cuisine and herbal medicine had survived to the modern day, had basically survived the Spanish Inquisition. So what I did was I went and lived in the Yucatan for about 8 months, and I studied people. I lived amongst Mayans in a community where the elderly members were still practicing very traditional forms of medicine and eating very traditional foods, and most of them were so ensconced in their own communities that they didn't even speak Spanish. The majority of my informants only spoke Mayan, and I actually had to befriend their children so that I could have translators from their parents' Mayan into the Spanish that the kids also spoke, so that I could then translate that into English for my notes. So it was quite an experience, and one of the things that was verified for me firsthand from all of my reading back in the library that I'd done at my college in Vermont was that insects were still very much part of the cuisine. So I went to this really tiny, really liberal, pretty unique college in rural Vermont called Marlborough. And it's about 300 students at its most swollen. And the deal is you do somewhat general education for the first 2 years. And then your final 2 years are, instead of just picking a major from a catalog, you design your own major. I mean, down to the last detail. You pick a subject, any subject you want to study, and if they don't have somebody on staff to teach it to you or guide you through it, they'll bring in an outside expert in the field. So literally, your palette is wide open. I mean, you can do anything you want, and which sounds great. You know, it sounds like woo party. You know, I'm going to study TV watching or something, which I'm sure some students have. But the catch is you have to write essentially a master's level thesis before they let you graduate. So we have this, and they're called plans. We have this room at the college library called the plan room, and you can go in, you can see every single student's plan from the beginning of the college's history. And it's basically this room full of bound black books. one for each graduated student that each student has written on his or her own. And these are incredibly in-depth, detailed explorations of subjects, each in itself, incredibly informative on whatever topic the student has chosen. So my project was pre-Columbian food and medicine. And getting back to the insects, so in studying for writing this lengthy, in-depth thesis. I did a lot of studying. I wanted to do a semester abroad in the Yucatan to see what vestiges, again, had survived from before the Spanish Inquisition of early native life in Mexico, specifically pertaining to nutrition and medicine. And I spent the first 6 months to a year, just reading books in the library in preparation for my trip. And I just remember it being the middle of the winter and finding this one book in our library. And I don't even remember what the book was, but I stumbled across this one passage, which was this anthropological argument between two schools of thought regarding Aztec cannibalism. And on the one side, you had an anthropologist who posited that the Aztecs lacked sufficient protein. in their daily diets. They didn't have large game the way that you did in other parts of the Americas. They didn't have buffalo or anything like that, bison. They had, you know, fowl. They had dogs and rabbits and small turkeys and fish, but they didn't have anything really, really big.
What about deer?
They had some smaller deer, but they just didn't have big game at that point. And so this guy was saying, well, because they lacked protein, instead of their practice of cannibalism being ritualistically motivated, basically, you know, the Aztecs glyphs tend to express that they ate each other in a way as a way to get closer to God. He was saying, no, they were biologically driven to do this because they just weren't getting enough protein, and they turned on each other. Now, this is a pretty hefty anthropological claim to make. I mean, that's saying a lot about a culture, that they just ate each other out of necessity. I mean, that's like Donner Party stuff, and, right? I mean, you know, it's taken a lot away from their cultural, you know, not just theology, but ideology. And, you know, in the Aztec culture, it's quite well respected. So he basically put this forth in an anthropological journal. And he was answered literally in the following other anthropological journals publications, you know, the very next publication, a whole bunch of other anthropologists who specialized in this region saying, no, you've got it all wrong. They were getting plenty of protein because of the diversity of animals that they consumed, largely consuming and supplemented by insects.
You know, it's interesting. I've been in Peru, and one of the things that Peruvians love to eat is cuy, which is, of course, guinea pig.
Yes.
And it tastes just like very fatty chicken. And people who have studied a little bit about nutrition know that saturated fats are, in fact, not bad for you. And they, in fact, power you and make you feel very good and well fed for the day. And so
yes.
Here's, you know, guinea pigs are just rich in this, they're high energy food. And so
yes.
Here are these little rodents, and they breed obviously like rodents. And, you know, it's a national food down there. So there are so many more options for food that we don't even consider, you know, in our Western culture.
It's so true, and it's so nuts, because as Westerners, I mean, we're really focused on food. We love food. And we're affluent enough to be able to draw on a variety of food sources. You know, you talk about saturated fat being necessary, especially if you don't have a diet that's high in a lot of highly processed carbohydrates. And other types of fats like Krispy Kreme donuts, yeah, you need all the high saturated fat you can get in those types
right.
of situations.
Well, and you know, I don't know if you're familiar with Sally Fallon's work, Nourishing Traditions, and her documentary, The Oiling of America. But she came out a few years ago, and I had her on my show, just completely leveling the idea that animal fats are bad for you. And that cholesterol, blood cholesterol, is caused by animal fats. And she shows with very good primary documentation that your body is actually reacting to all of the vegetable oils and the sugars, and it gets inflamed, and so then creates the cholesterol to take care of the inflammation from the sugars and processed carbos and these nasty vegetable oils, and that's the real killer there. And you know,
it's
fascinating. when you go back and you think pre 1900 or 1910, and you think what people ate and what did, you know, a pemmican or pemmican, whatever that stuff was that the Indians ate, it was a chunk of fat that they filled with spices and herbs and stuff, and they would go for walks for days or weeks just eating that and having plenty of nutrition to feed themselves with it.
Right, right. And again, and these were situations where they didn't have all of this junk food to quote-unquote sustain themselves with.
Are you saying, Daniela, that they didn't have McDonald's then?
That's what I'm saying. They didn't have Snickers bars, etc. So
No
they
Twinkies?
Really, no.
1800s, none of that?
No. Well, you know, it's funny that you say that because you just brought up a Native American tradition, and, you know, fry bread is the bane and also, you know, a sort of a staple of a lot of Native American modern day diets. But it is, and it's interesting because something like fry bread, you know, you mentioned pemmican. Something like fry bread is sort of the modern day equivalent of pemmican, but it has that high level of fat, but it does the opposite for your body because it has a lot of processed, it's processed white flour, which has had most of the nutrition removed from it, and it's
right.
Like lard.
It comes with, what, 24 nutrients, and then they bleach it, and they put 7 or something back?
Yeah, exactly. So it's a modern-day equivalent in terms of its popularity, but it doesn't, chemically speaking, it doesn't do the same things for your body. But yes, I agree, and I think that people should be turning more towards pure, clean, natural animal fats, as opposed to, yeah, a lot of the processed crap that we eat today. And I think that you would be healthier with that type of a thing. Speaking of which, that that's probably why I find larvae so appealing. They're sort of the veal of the insect world because they're basically the tender, fat young.
Okay, so, fun. You know, when most people think of maggots, they don't think of delicious treat, you know, how does that, I mean,
well,
you know, you see larvae and maggots and you just go, that looks like a great dinner. Is that what I'm getting?
Yes, no, you know, that has evolved over time. Now maggots, it's used as a general kind of a blanket term for squirmy things.
Sure.
But it's very specific. Maggots are,
and in my usage intentionally as well.
Yes. Well, no, it's important. Maggots are specifically the larva of flies. Okay. And they are known for their pretty specific diets. I mean, maggots in general eat meat. They generally eat rotting meat. And thank goodness they do, otherwise have stinky rotting corpses under our feet at all times.
And not only that, but if you take maggots and you put them on rotting flesh, let's say if you have some gangrene going on, they will clean it up and heal it. And they do not eat any healthy meat. They only eat rotten flesh. Is that correct?
No, that's not correct.
Oh, it's not correct. They do eat some of the healthy meat.
So I have eaten maggots. Well, I've eaten the second stage of maggots, which is pupae, where they basically turn into these little silver pellets. They're actually quite attractive, which have been fed on decent meat, not something disgusting. And they tasted just like blood sausage. So, you know,
blood sausage.
Blood sausage, yes. And I do believe that there are some maggots that will only feed on the rotting parts of the meat, which is why they can be used in medicine. But again, so just to be clear, just to make the distinction between maggots and all other larvae, I don't really go for maggots, especially those that have been fed on rotting meat, because, you know, I mean, when you go to buy beef at the grocery store, I mean, people are even concerned with what that beef is eating, and that's a fairly complex animal. I mean, the bugs, it's you know, they have such a short lifespan. That they really are what they eat. So I think that's a bit of a consideration about eating insects. Anyway, getting back to larvae. So when I speak of larvae, I'm talking about generally moth larvae, butterfly larvae, caterpillars, in other words.
Oh, that's so you like to eat the ones that everyone are fond of.
Well, no, actually, one of my favorite type of larvae are something called they're called wax worms. They're not actually worms. They're the caterpillar of the lesser wax moth, which is actually a parasite on beehives. They will go in like Pac-Man and they'll eat their way through a hive. They'll eat wax and pollen and steal some of the honey and eat some of the baby bees. And they're you know, definitely a parasite and a pain in the hive for beekeepers. And they are absolutely delicious. They are very high in essential fatty acids, the same types of omegas that you'd get from eating fish. And they taste like little mushroomy pine nuts.
Or for those hemp seed oil fans out there.
Yes, yes, exactly. And whenever I serve these at events, I bake them in the oven at about 350 degrees for maybe 5 or 10 minutes, and they become these golden little crunchy kernels. And people go nuts for them. They love them. They eat handful after handful. I recently served them to my very, very pregnant friend, and she ate the entire bowl in one sitting, just because they're absolutely delicious, and they're very healthy. They, you know, in the wild, they live on honey and wax and basically whatever whatever they find in beehives. But in captivity, they're fed on a diet of bran and honey exclusively. And they taste great. And, I know I'm crossing a lot of subjects here, but one thing I really like about them in particular is they're incredibly easy to raise. And, you know, the locavore movement is really gaining a foothold for a number of reasons in, well, specifically, I know of it in American society. I presume it's in other countries where they value their food and their food sources as well. The locavore movement is important because of a number of reasons, not the smallest of which is that you save fuel when you don't have to transport your food long distances, right? So somebody who's eating locally is helping contribute to lessening global warming because they're not, you know, their food isn't being trucked for long distances, number one.
You mean like when you buy a steak at Trader Joe's and they're importing it from South America?
That is exactly what I mean. That's exactly what I mean.
And you know, it's like you go to buy an organic steak and it comes from Uruguay.
Yes.
And between me and Mammoth, you know, is this 395 highway, and it's literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles of the most beautiful grassland valley that you can imagine, going right through the middle of Central California. And there are major ranches along the whole route, and
right.
yet you can't pull over and buy any of that meat anywhere.
Right. It's absurd. It's absurd. The food system, I'm certainly not the first to poke a finger at the food system and the structure in the U.S. It's crazy. It's nuts. It's nuts. And anyway, so the locavore movement, this is one of the, you know, the environmental factor of the fuel usage is one reason. Another reason is that you are supporting your local community, which is really good. And a third reason is hopefully you'll have more of a notion of how the food is produced. There'll be more transparency if you can just walk down to the farm or drive down to the farm or whatever and make sure, you know, really see how they're raising things. And insects play into the locavore vision amazingly well, because there's literally no such thing as a space that's too small to raise bugs, as any urbanite will tell you. I mean, you can raise an insect crop in a dorm room. You can raise it in your office cubicle. There's literally no such thing as a space too small or too... I mean, it's not even the same as raising crops, because you need, I mean, those have seasons, you need sunlight, you need an outdoor space for them generally, unless you're doing hydroponics or a greenhouse. And bugs, I mean, you need a plastic bin in your kitchen. You don't, you know, you just need a place that has, you know, the type of, you know,
okay.
room temperature.
I'm thinking of veal right now and pita.
Yes.
So now let's, you know, I can't imagine that if you're talking about keeping bugs in a cubicle in a box and they don't even need light or anything, the way that PETA people freak out over veal, I mean, insects, because you would be cramming hundreds of insects in a little box in that little
right.
space. So that must be like 10,000 times worse to PETA people.
Well, not all species are the same. A calf would benefit physically, well, not from the veal perspective, but psychologically at least, from being in a wide open, sunny, clean field with its brethren, right? With its other cows.
Right, but definitely not for the veal perspective. I see that point.
Exactly. But have you ever opened a bin of flour in your kitchen and seen mealworms in it? You may not have had this experience, but
Well, I have. So you're saying that this happens naturally, whether or not you ate it along.
Exactly. Exactly. It is not psychologically damaging to
the bugs.
Many forms of larvae, specifically, particularly those that eat various types of meal, like mealworms or wax moth larvae and things like that. This, they would prefer it. They're completely happy to, as Dana Goodyear put it in her article in the New Yorker entitled Grub, insects are perfectly happy to team, T-E-E-M. They don't mind teaming together. They don't mind being, you know, kind of wriggling in there with their brethren as they all eat bran in a nice, warm, cozy, enclosed, dark space. This is great for them.
So has PETA attacked you or any of your work anyway?
They have not attacked me. They have attacked people that I know of. They've attacked other people who are raising insects for food. PETA...
Well, you know, PETA are people who think that Africa should have chain-link fences across it to keep the lions from eating the herbivores and things like that, you know, and stopping the natural process of nature and yin and yang and, you know, Shiva and Vishnu and all the things that make life, life and death.
Well, PETA really believes that it's not okay to take advantage of animals in any way, which I respect. I think that's a very beautiful, loving notion of life, of other life forms.
But at the same time, though, I see so many of these people caring so much about animals and then care nothing about homeless and other people and issues that, you know, I think that animals tend to be put even before humanity in many situations like that.
Well, can you blame them?
Well, no, but that's
by and large.
But that's a mirror image of the problem. That's not being a solution to it. You know, that's aggravating the problem, and I think it's, you know, endemic in our culture.
Yes, I hear what you're saying. Although I don't know from Peter's perspective why they feel that they should champion their own species above other species. That's kind of what they're against. So having said that, I guess I have two parallel and somewhat opposing perspectives when it comes to PETA. On the one hand, I really respect their loving heart for animal kind. I do. I think that's a lovely notion, and I think that there are some animals that need to eat other animals to survive. For instance, I own a tarantula. There's no way I can feed that tarantula on anything but other animals. I have to feed her insects or she will die. But humans are a different story. I mean, we can survive on a vegetarian diet. Personally, speaking from experience, I don't survive well when I only eat vegetables. I thrive physically.
And that's what Sally Fallon shows in her work, is that, you know, animal products are absolutely essential for our diet and for our development and things like that.
Yes.
And whether or not you're getting it from insects or animals is a totally different issue. But I think, you know, when you look at the evidence that she presents and you put it in the larger context of, say, eugenics, which I hate to go there without laying out a whole lot of evidence, but my last two interviews go into that sufficiently for those interested, with Kevin Annette and Clint Richardson, and looking at how diet and nutrition and vegetable oils and getting people to believe that eating animals and animal fat is bad for you, I think has been a major cause of the cancer and obesity and rampant health problems that we're seeing right now. And so, you know, it's and people are eating twice as much food in this country than they were, you know, 20 or 30 years ago. So, the corporations are producing worse quality food and people are eating more of this crap. You know, it's like when you go to the grocery store, you buy your food on the outside of the store, not in the middle. The middle of the store has the processed foods. The outside of the store has the whole foods.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's and what they're doing is they've gotten everybody to buy their food from the middle of the store, and it's they need twice as much of it. It's high in sugar, high in processed carbs and vegetable oils that are totally toxic. And you know, that is the problem. If people focused on eating better quality food, we would need a lot less of it, and it would be a lot more sustainable.
I do. I mean, I agree with what you're saying. I guess I still, the idealist in me has a lot of respect for somebody who would, you know, care for other beings so much that they just would be unable to eat them, and that they would even sacrifice to some extent their own optimal health to, you know, in favor of only eating vegetarian products as much as possible. I mean, I do think that that's a beautiful philosophy.
Oh, I totally agree with that. And I was vegan for 3 years and vegetarian another 3 years, so 6 years total. So
you know.
I get it. And it wrecked me. wrecked me. So,
right.
You know, and when I went back, you know, when I discovered Sally Fallon's work and everything, it was one of those moments of, aha, no wonder
yes.
Every time I ate greasy bacon and eggs, I felt great all day.
Yes,
and
exactly.
So, you know, that's,
exactly.
Anyway, so. So
having said that, I and it's not just because I don't want to tick anybody off, although there is a slight part of that, but truly deep in my heart, I do think that it's beautiful to care for other beings. And I do, I think that's a beautiful way of life. Number one, having said that, I think that what gets overlooked, that insects do get, it's not possible to live a life, even a vegetarian or a vegan lifestyle, without murdering billions of bugs. It's endemic to the process of both growing and harvesting and processing. Despite the fact that I believe the ideology of protecting all animal life and avoiding eating it is beautiful, it is impossible to eat, for the most part, in an industrialized society specifically, without murdering millions of insects. In order to grow food, in order to grow crops, you destroy the existing ecosystem and all the bugs that were living in it, and you create a sort of artificial ecosystem, which brings in different insects. Then, when you harvest the food, unless you harvest every piece, you know, even when you harvest every piece by hand,
who's that tribe in India or the Middle East that sweeps the road in front of them to make sure they don't step on bugs and
right? But what do you think they're eating? I mean, all of that corn. When you harvest a cornfield, most people don't do that by hand because it would just be a waste of time and man hours that we can't afford. You would use industrial harvesting technology, and these machines, you know, threshers, for instance. What do you think they're threshing? What do you think's sitting on every single corn stalk? What do you think is hanging out on every single, you know, wheat stalk?
How many bugs and bug fragments does the government allow, and how much food?
Well, I mean, it varies per food item. So that's even the next step. So first of all, you know, we're talking about all the bugs that get just obliterated during the harvesting process. All right, then you bring that food in for processing. And in the processing and the grinding up of all that wheat, a lot of bugs get into the mix. A lot of bugs get into the mix. I don't have the figure offhand for wheat. If you go to the FDA website, they actually have an entire page that will tell you how much is allowed in each type of processed food. Because everything that's processed is likely to have some bug matter in it. For an example, the one that I like to keep on hand is chocolate. About 30 insect pieces or fragments are allowed in 100 grams of chocolate. And 100 grams of chocolate is about as much as you can hold piled in the palm of your hand. That's a lot of bug for 100 grams.
So when you think of all those bug fragments, you're just like, you know, that's what makes the chocolate taste so good.
Well, there's that. There's that. There's the fact that insects are contributing to even the most vegan and vegetarian nutrition spectrum. Right? There's really no such thing as bug-free
really,
food.
That's really humorous when you lay it all out like that. It actually almost makes vegetarianism in that sense absurd, because then, you know, even when you're trying to be vegetarian, you're still getting a lot of bug protein and nutrients that you would need that you otherwise wouldn't get being a vegetarian.
That's exactly right. And I do try not to tick people off for strategic reasons. I believe
right. Well,
that,
this is a very politically incorrect show, so they're ready for it. You know?
Well, no, I want to maintain a dialogue. I want to keep the lines of communication as open as possible, because I really do want this topic to get across to people. The place I do get frustrated by and confused by vegans and vegetarians, because I do get some flack. On the articles that I write and the interviews that I do, I hear from vegetarians and vegans, and they're horrified that I'm bringing yet another animal into the carnivory mix. They're horrified. Oh, you're bringing in a whole new species for us to now slaughter and kill. And I get frustrated by that for two reasons. Number one, if we can create a market for the insects, for edible insects in general, maybe instead of going out and just needlessly obliterating them when we do our harvesting, what if we could send out a bunch of the same type of pickers that pick strawberries, for instance, to pick all the marketable bugs off the crops and sell them? I mean, isn't that better than just killing them needlessly? Number one. Number two, despite my respect for the vegetarian and vegan lifestyle, it is not applicable to starving nations in places
it's not healthy either
in places where protein deficiency inhibits and affects brain growth, in places where there's not sufficient arable land to grow enough crops. Creating protein out of things that humans would be throwing away, it's a great option. You would never dream of taking potential food out of a starving person's mouth. And people always come back with overpopulation. You know, don't we need to let parts of our population die off so that we can maintain balance? You know, and I think that's a great theoretical notion.
You know, it's funny that you say that. We did a documentary together, my team and I, with Richard Andrew Grove, Paul Verge, and myself. And this documentary, episode one, is the only one we put out so far. It's called What You've Been Missing. And we do a whole thing on this population thing and food supplies. And, you know, when you look at it, in every instance, it's greed that is keeping people from getting access to the food. And these corporations that withhold food to drive up market prices and things like that. And you know, and also warfare preventing food and supplies from getting places when it's sent in, you know, like
yes.
From the Red Cross and stuff like that. And then you have military stealing the food and all of these things. And, you know, the real issue is that as long as there is greed, they will never, ever, ever fix the starvation problem. If they killed 90% of the population tomorrow, we would still have a starving population. Because of these greedy people out there who do these things and try and control everything. So, you know, you need to get, there's got to be some way to establish a system that doesn't, you know, food should not be a corporate commodity. Sure, you should, you know, a farmer should be allowed to make a profit on it, but it's when these corporations paying stockholders who never even see the food or go to the field or see the farm or the ranch or anything else, when they get their hands in it, when the bankers get their hands in it, that's when the problems start.
Well, I'd like to speak to that. What you've just mentioned ties into a lot of the things that I've talked about thus far, and that are some of the strongest reasons that I advocate for eating insects. I would say the majority of world hunger experts agree that the problem of world hunger is not the content of food on the planet, but rather distribution. It's getting food from places like the American heartland, where crops grow great, to places like the Horn of Africa, where they have issues with that kind of thing. They just don't have equal land. It just doesn't work the same. Irrigation is impossible in many places. And the edible insect movement, as I was mentioning before, talking about locavorism and how insects can be grown anywhere, and often on things that humans won't or can't eat or digest. The idea is that if, and this is why I get frustrated with the vegetarians and vegans and PETA who yell at me about introducing a new life form to kill, which is not true, by the way. It's rather the first life form to kill. I'm sorry, I'm going to take a quick tangent here. When you think of evolution, one of the things they point at is apes learning to use tools, right? Yeah. So you're making a movement of an ape licking a stick and sticking it in the anthill, right?
That's exactly
what
I was doing.
That's the first thing you think about, right? When you think of the first tool that we used,
right. What Daniela was commenting on is she can see me on the camera here, and I was taking my hand like I had a stick in it and sticking it down an ant hole to lick the ants off the stick. So
right.
She picked up on that right off the bat.
So that's basically the first tool that we think of in terms of primate evolution. So I am by no means am I encouraging some new form of animal slaughter. This is the oldest form of animal slaughter. Anyway, so I get frustrated by that, by that type of backlash, because what we need is, if we could possibly get some more societal acceptance in Western nations of insects as food, that's the first way we can start getting real research dollars. Our ultimate goal for, I would say, the majority of us in the entomophagy movement is to start teaching people in areas where they don't have proper arable land how to grow insects on things that they would ordinarily be throwing away, thus sidestepping the issue of distribution. Basically, if we could kind of grow virally from, you know, intra village and even intra home food growth, you wouldn't have to bring in food from outside, and all of these ideas that you're talking about, all of these blockages, would hopefully be circumvented. Do you see it? Do you see the awesome, elegant logic of it?
You know what? Here's what I see also, is that the elites and these eugenicists like Bill Gates and these other people that want to kill and cull the masses, they must not like what you have to say, because what you're offering is a very home-based solution that, you know, people don't need to grow chickens, they don't need to raise pigs, they don't need to raise cows. They can put a little box in the drawer and create a sustainable source of protein and food that will feed them and their whole family, and very sustainably, and for pennies, literally.
Exactly. It's almost too easy. Sorry, I'm obsessed with this line from Wayne's World lately.
So let me ask you this. How did you go from studying bugs and the anthropology of nutrition to what made you say, you know what, I'm just going to start macking these bugs?
It's a great question. I was recently asked to come and give a talk at one of the classes at my alma mater, the Marlborough that I graduated from. And that's what I was telling these students, is that, you know, I went to this weird small school and I focused on this weird small topic, you know, pre-Columbian nutrition and medicine, in Mexico. And how do I say this right? Most people go on from their college careers and they, many people at least, go into careers that have nothing to do with what they actually studied in their undergrad. time. But for me, after having written this thesis, the part of it that I always found the most interesting was the part about edible insects. Of all those 2 years of research and writing that I did, the part that I liked best was the part about edible insects. And in years later, when people would ask me, you know, what did you study in college, I would tell them, and I would always come back to the part about edible insects. That was the part that was just the most interesting. And I later on wanted to get into ethnonutrition and advocating that. And I was really interested in hosting TV shows. I was actually an online game show host for a year. I was the world's first online game show host for a company called PlayCafe.com. And I really wanted to be kind of like a travel show host for ethnonutrition. Something like, you know, bizarre foods, only more anthropologically based. But what I was really, again, what I was most interested in was the edible insects aspect. And I always thought in my head, well, you know, I'll kind of make a career for myself doing this other stuff, and I'll get around to the bug stuff once I've gotten established. Once I've become legitimate, then I'll get into this edible bug stuff. You know, like it was all a means to an end. And finally, one day I woke up and I was just like, you know, this is the thing that really gets me going. This is the thing I'm really passionate about and that is really interesting and unique. Why don't I just, you know, put all that other stuff aside? I'll get to that stuff later. Why don't I focus in on this? And that was about, I would say, 3 years ago that I started, and I put up a website and I started filming the Girl Meets Bug cooking show, and you know, the rest is really history. It's oddly enough, that's the thing that's really what I've found traction with.
Is the decision of eating bugs based on taste or food value?
That's a great question, and it's a tough one to answer. There is so much mental cultural stigma around eating insects that I believe it literally has like a psychosomatic effect on your tongue. There are so many odd, intense flavors that we relish because they have been deemed delicacies. Prior to the 1850s, for instance, lobster and shellfish were used as pig feed. They were not considered, because they were so abundant, for one thing, they just weren't considered good food at all until they were basically remarketed. Oysters, for instance, if you ever eaten a raw oyster, it's slimy, it has a weird taste, it's gross. It's like swallowing a bolus of snot. Am I right? I mean, I love oysters.
Yeah.
I love oysters.
I think I've had a couple raw ones, but...
Fine. Even a broiled mussel has a very peculiar, odd taste. Escargot. This is a really weird thing to eat, but because it's been culturally remarketed, we think it tastes great.
Well, you know, it's funny that you should bring up escargot. When I was a kid, my mom used to make it all the time. And of course, she would never tell anybody what it was until after dinner.
Exactly.
And so everybody would have literally licked their plates clean.
Yeah.
And then she would say, "Do you know what that was? That was snails." And everybody would, you know, like my aunt one time was over for dinner. After she literally cleaned her plate, she ran to the bathroom to throw up when she found out that it was snails.
That's a great example and a great story. I have a similar one from my friend Barry Roth, who's a slug expert in Northern California, who has a story about a friend of his whose wife sent him out. They lived in Sausalito. She sent him out clamming so they could have clams and white sauce on linguine. And he didn't find any clams, but he did see a bunch of banana slugs. And he was like, well, what the heck? And he brought home the banana slugs and he chopped them up. And he made them just as he would have made the clams, served them to his wife, who thought they were delicious, you know, said, "These are such great clams. Where did you find them?" He told her the truth. And after she had thoroughly enjoyed her meal, went to go vomit it all up. So the mental aspect is strong. It really is strong with them. Having said that, there are many insect species, not all, that do taste legitimately and objectively great. I would say the majority of the white larvae that I've eaten and that I've served to other people, so for instance, you know, like wax moth larvae, they really do taste like a cross between a pine nut and an enoki mushroom. Are you familiar with the long, skinny Japanese mushrooms? They taste just like that crossed with a pine nut. Really, they do. They're fantastic. But because it's a bug, your brain does this funny thing with the idea of it.
I was going to ask you about bee larvae in a second, but let me just say real quick, you know, it's like when you go to these sushi restaurants and they feed you a fried shrimp head
and sea urchin.
You know, and people think that that's absolutely delicious and they can eat fried shrimp heads all day. And what is a shrimp really but, I suppose, a scorpion, right, for water?
Only worse because, I mean, shrimp are, you know, they're taking in various bad aspects of the oceans, mercury and whatnot. They're also not, I don't think they're all that clean when it comes to what they eat. Shrimp are one of the things that are not kosher. You know, there are religions.
Well, aren't only locusts kosher though? If you want to go that direction,
they are. But at least locusts are kosher. Shrimp aren't.
Well,
for reasons.
I don't know if I would put much weight on that one though.
Well, of course I don't. Of course I don't. It really is this cultural matrix within which we are completely trapped when it comes to experiencing our world. So that's one of the things that we're really hoping to work on. We're really hoping that we can have the same type of turnover that they had in the 1850s regarding shellfish and crustaceans about the land versions of those. Because really there is such a close biological tie that there's shellfish allergy warnings for people eating insects. In fact, something like a grasshopper is more closely related to a shrimp than it is to a scorpion.
Really? Very interesting. Wow.
Yes. Yeah.
You know what? I got to ask you this, because I know with my show and my background, somebody's going to ask this. Are there any psychedelic bugs out there?
I sincerely doubt it. I mean, are there any psychedelic fish? I mean, I seem to remember
one psychedelic fish being reported 3 or 4 years ago. I would have to dig around on my computer and see if I could find the article.
I think it's possible that there is an insect that has some type of a toxin that would have a mental effect.
I do know that many American Native tribes would take like spider poison and things like that, and snake poisons, and rub them on the epidermis. Uh-huh. To absorb topically, and they would have experiences that way. But I'm just wondering if you've ever heard of any that were psychoactive on eating.
No, but I think it would be really interesting if you, because again, an insect is it's so much lower on the food chain that they really are what they eat. So I wonder if you could somehow feed them.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you say that now that I think about it, and coming right back to the top of the topic of bees, so this is a perfect segue. And I interviewed Stephen Booner a couple of years ago on my show, and he's a well-known botanist, and he has written a book on psychedelic beer is basically herbal and magic healing, or herbal and healing beers, or healing and herbal beers, or something like that is the title of his book. And he does a whole lot on bees and their impact and everything, and on honey. And it's well documented in ancient documents of like soldiers preparing for a battle or something and finding a big pot of, you know, a big batch of honey that was made from a plant that was poisonous, and basically putting the entire mass of troops to sleep for a day or two while they recovered from this honey.
Yes. Speaking of which, that's a great segue. The Nepalese honey hunters harvest honey from the largest bee in the world, for one thing. And there's this certain type of, I think it's a native azalea or something like that. They are the bees that live in the highest altitude of any other bees, and they're the largest bees. And the vegetation from which they gather their nectar is so hardy and sort of impervious, has had to become so impervious to the elements that they're very, very strong have very strong pharmacological properties in the vegetation itself. And this particular honey, which is harvested by the tribal members hanging down on this rope in front of the cliff, because the bees build their hives like into these cliffs, and it's this very dangerous harvesting process. But this honey fetches like 6 times higher price on the market, number one. Number two, it's so potent that if you ate it straight, you'd just pass out instantly. Number three, it's got these both analgesic and opioid properties in it, such that it's being researched it's actually being prescribed as almost like an alternative to methadone for people who are getting off of opioid addictions, because it's got this real tranquilizing, soothing, analgesic property. So what you're saying is absolutely true, and I definitely think that there would be potential in terms of creating this potent honey that's been kind of digested through these other organisms. It ties into something else. There for a while there, and I think it still exists, there was a certain type of nutritional supplement that you could take that was whole foods digested by bacteria. And the idea was that this was, instead of just taking, extracting the vitamins from whole foods and then feeding them back into your natural organism of a body, this was apparently a much more natural and biologically assimilatable. You know what I mean?
Yes.
It was much easier to assimilate because it was so closely linked to the whole food itself. So I think that translating nutrients through insects into the human body is a very interesting idea.
What's the worst insect you've ever eaten?
It's a tie. I ate a Madagascar hissing cockroach once. And it was like really greasy day-old chicken, and I did not like it. Just didn't like it. It was just really...
That's funny, because I can't stand leftovers, and chicken is one of, right up there on the very top of worst leftovers.
Yeah, it's really like just the worst low quality. I just didn't like it at all. Other people have eaten them, and they think they're great. I just did not like. Once I ate kind of a walking stick, one of these really big, you know, almost like a foot long walking stick, bug, and it just tasted like leaves, like the leaves it had been eating. That's the other thing. Again, insects really are what they eat, which is why a lot of people don't find earthworms all that tasty, because literally they've been eating dirt and they taste like it. So I think most insects, although surprisingly, I ate dung beetles once and they were fantastic. So
dung beetles don't taste like dung, huh?
No, they tasted great. They were really great. They were fried, but they were fantastic.
Either that, or maybe that says something about what cow poop tastes like.
Maybe. I don't know how much dung dung beetles actually eat. I know they roll it a lot. I don't know how much.
Yeah, well, you know, and it's worshipped like the sun, because they roll the ball on the ground like the sun going across the sky, and
yeah.
All kinds of interesting symbology there. So what's the tastiest bug you've had?
Ooh, I think the tastiest have been, it's really tough. So it's bees and ants are related biologically. Very closely related compared to other insects. And my two favorites have been, my top three favorites have been bee larva, ant larva, and wasp larva. So anything in that kind of category is usually really good, really buttery, and really kind of bacony, oddly enough.
Interesting. Yeah. I read that on your site, some recipe that you were mixing honey or bees and honey and something, and it tasted like bacon.
It really tastes like bacon, like a mushroomy bacon. It's astounding. It's really surprising. It doesn't, you know.
Now, I've got really keen olfactory senses. Why do ants stink so bad to me? I can smell an ant from a foot to 2 feet away.
You may have a sensitivity. I don't know why you would think that they stink. I've never smelled an ant.
Really?
I can smell cockroaches.
I like, if there's an ant crawling across my kitchen counter, I can smell it from 2 feet away.
That's astounding. I've never, ever heard that before. What does it smell like?
Oh, it's the most awful, just... It's absolutely hideous. I mean, next time you see one of those little sugar ants crawling across your counter, go smash it and stick it up to your nose and see if you can smell it. But you know, I not only can I smell it when it's up against my nose, I can literally smell it, you know, maybe 18 inches, but usually probably 18 inches to 2 feet away is where I can smell them. And I know when they're around.
I don't know the answer to that. The only thing I would have to offer is maybe it's the formic acid that's irritating your nostrils. You know, formic acid is I don't think there's any ant species that doesn't have it. And it's you know, it's a serious acid. It can give people real stomach aches when they eat the big stinging ones. And it's the reason that in China, for instance, they sell big shakers full of dried ants, because it's kind of like a pepper. It's got a very spicy aspect to it. So I don't know. That's the only thing I can imagine that would cause that. I don't know the answer to that. I don't know.
All right. So do you want to go into recipes or anything? Do we dare go there? Do you want to teach people how to cook bugs?
Yeah, I absolutely do. I absolutely do. What I really want is to kind of ease people's intimidation when it comes to crossing the border between...
I think you should just give them the most frightening thing right up front, and then we'll go back.
All right. Well, the most frightening thing you can probably do... Oh, boy. Would that be scorpions or tarantulas?
And I watched your video of you making fried scorpion.
Yes, yes, and that's really tasty. I mean, I've served that to hundreds of people, and they all agree it tastes just like crab. Only a crab that's better for you, because it hasn't been eating detritus on the ocean floor. Let's see. Well, all right. When you cook tarantula, for instance. And mind you, I've learned a lot, all of this stuff from those who have gone before me in this field. You know,
and you do have a pet, experts. And you do have a pet tarantula. For all of those out there who are tarantula lovers, you are a tarantula lover as well.
I am a tarantula lover.
But you just love them more ways than one. That's all.
Well, here's my rationalization. I do every tarantula that I kill and eat. I feel badly about it. And I firmly believe that's how one should feel when you kill and eat an animal. You should feel some sorrow for the life lost. I just don't think it's...
Let me interrupt you for a second. Isn't that like when you go take a bow and arrow or a rifle and you go out into the field and you shoot a duck or a deer or whatever on your own, and you have to sit there and clean it and take care of it and do all of that? You get that connection, other than going to the grocery store and taking it out of a piece of plastic so that you're completely removed from the life and death process. You know, so what you're saying is that when you have to cook a cockroach or an insect, it's forcing you to go right back and face that whole life-death reality that we're all in.
That is precisely what I'm saying. You said it perfectly. That is exactly how I feel about it. Exactly how I feel about it. And I feel like that's how we should feel when we eat animals. We should feel sad. We should value the life that we're taking. Now, yes, I do eat tarantulas and I do eat scorpions. And I've heard from people, but, you know, oh, I thought we weren't supposed to eat predators. What do you think a salmon is? What do you think a sardine is? Those are predators also, and we have no problem eating those. I almost feel like it's unfair to rank them in that sense. You know, is it fair to say that a tarantula is somehow better than a salmon just because we like them and we assign this sort of mythic quality to them? It's not really fair. Having said that, no, I don't want to eat dogs and cats. I feel really strongly about that. But I do know, I do sort of realize that it's hypocritical.
Have you eaten dog?
Well, yes. When I visited China, I stayed with a family that served dog. So, I mean, it would have been very rude for me to turn it down. And yes, I did. And no, I didn't like it.
Well, and you said that it may have been because of your own cultural conditioning that it tasted like wet dog?
Yeah, it did. And again, if I'd grown up with cows and I was accustomed to that smell as sort of a cuddly, familial smell, I probably wouldn't want to be able to eat hamburgers either. But, you know, I haven't grown up with that.
Well, look at India, you know, and here we are, you know.
Exactly. Exactly. Exactly what you're saying. So, yes, to all the arachnid lovers out there, I'm one of you. However, there are cultures that do eat tarantulas, and it is possible to raise them sustainably.
You just love tarantulas in more than one way. That's all. You're not a tarantula hater. You're a multi-lover.
I'm a multi-lover. The reason I do continue to eat tarantulas, especially in my public demonstrations, is they are an excellent catalyst for intrigue. People get interested. They see you burning the hairs off of a tarantula. Obviously, it's already dead. I'm not torturing spiders. And I would never do that. They see you doing that. They are drawn in. They want to see what you have to say. They want to hear you. So, you know, right now I guess I'm using them as tools, and they do. They taste great. They taste really good. So if you want to eat a tarantula, what you do, you get a tarantula, you freeze it, you take it out of the refrigerator, and you cut off its abdomen. Again, it's frozen. It's not feeling any pain. It's dead. You cut off the abdomen. That's the round part where the web comes out of. There's just, you know, kind of fluid in there. It's a fluid-filled sac, which part of that fluid is pre-web components. So you cut that right off. It can burst in a frying pan. Then you basically stick the carapace.
So
you don't
eat the abdomen at all. You just stay away from that, huh?
I don't eat it. I just don't eat it. It's just kind of one of the reasons is that the tarantulas that I generally eat are called Chilean rose hairs, and on their abdomen they actually have something called urticating hairs, which they basically kick off at their enemies, and they're these very irritating hairs. You certainly wouldn't want to get into your throat, so I just take it off altogether. Then you take the carapace, which is the upper part, basically the head of the tarantula, the part that all the legs come out of. You stick that on a stick, and you can do one of two things. You can either burn off the hairs with a lighter, or you can spritz it with like Bacardi 150, some very high octane alcohol, and you do a quick little tarantula flambe, and it's really cool to look at. And it gets the job done. It burns off the majority of the hairs, and then you basically go and you do a spot check with the lighter and you get off the rest. Then you dredge it, or you dip it into like a tempura batter, and then you fry it. And it's fantastic. And it's actually, what I often will do is I'll kind of take the legs off and I'll arrange them into sort of a shrimp cocktail type of an arrangement. And it's a great alternative to shrimp, because what many people don't know is that shrimp trawler nets can capture a lot of unwanted sea life, for instance, endangered turtles. So I would actually say that tarantula leg cocktail could be potentially preferable to shrimp. So that's one way you do it, and apparently it's I usually serve it with like a spicy chili sauce, but I learned recently from a chef friend of mine that it's really good with cocktail sauce, just like fried shrimp is. So that's probably the scariest induction into entomophagy. Somewhat easier would be taking crickets, and then they're really easy. You just get some live crickets. You can get them from your pet store, local pet store. Put them in the freezer as is, overnight. Once they're frozen, you just rinse them off, and they are ready to cook with. You can saute them. You can roast them. You can put them on skewers and grill them. You can, once they're roasted, you can grind them into powder, this very highly nutritious powder, which is really high in iron, for instance, if you're pregnant or anemic. You can add that into smoothies or muffin recipes or sprinkle it on salads. It's got this very nutty taste. That's actually probably the wussy way into eating insects. I would say crickets are kind of the gateway bug.
You know, it's interesting, you know, and this is a topic, I'll be honest, this is a topic that I've been interested in for probably at least 10 years. I read a newspaper article years ago, probably when I was working way back in the day for the Los Angeles Times, and they were doing a write-up about this huge new Mexican cuisine industry in southern Mexico that was based on bugs, and it was bringing in tourists from all over the world.
Yes.
And I was, you know, very interested in going down there and trying it, and I never did, but it's something that I've had an interest in, and, you know, except for the occasional mistakenly eaten bug, I don't think, you know, and maybe except when I was a kid, I don't think that I've ever just gone out and intentionally eaten bugs.
Yeah, well, I'm telling you, it's the kind of thing where people hear about it online or they read an article and they have this kind of knee jerk, you know, bad reaction to it.
Well, my reaction was, well, that's very interesting. I would like to go do that. And so when I came across your work, it was just instantly, well, I came across that before. And so this is somebody who can actually teach me what it's all about, you know, and so take it from implicit to explicit knowledge. So,
yes, yes. And if you are someone who wants to try it and you're still a little skittish about handling it yourself, if you live in a metropolitan area, it's likely that you'll be able to find a Mexican, specifically Oaxacan, traditional restaurants often serve something called chapulines, which is a form of basically a sautéed grasshopper with chili and lime. And that's basically, you know, that was my first bug that I ever ate in Oaxaca. But yeah, that's something that most people can try without too much effort or investment.
Did you want to hit some more recipes?
Let's see. So yeah, I would say my top two recipes that I recommend for novices would be crickets, or again, as I was talking a lot about earlier, waxworms. These are something, again, that you can order online. A lot of pet stores do carry them or can order them for you.
But for flavor-wise, you would say tarantula, probably.
No, actually, flavor-wise, I would say waxworms.
Waxworms, okay.
Yeah. Well, tarantulas are great. They do. They taste great, but they're more preparatory work, I would say. They're more preparatory work. There's more shell to deal with.
How do you get the meat out of the legs? Do you need like a nutcracker like you have for, or do you use the side of your fork like you do for crab legs? Or,
well, the legs kind of, their exoskeleton is generally thin enough that it's sort of like eating soft shell crab where you kind of eat the whole thing. So the legs are a little chewy, but then again, you're getting all that calcium from the chitin in their exoskeleton, that their exoskeleton is made of. And then for the carapace itself, yeah, you could use a little nutcracker or something like that. Same kind of thing you'd use for a crab leg to get the meat out of there. And oddly enough, some of the best meat is attached to the fangs, to the chelicerae themselves. So I've had, you know, kids at my events sucking the meat out of tarantula fangs. You know, happily.
That's, I wouldn't even think that they would be big enough that you could really suck them like that. That's fascinating.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. They are often big enough, especially the adults. And they have plenty of muscle on there, and it's very tasty.
So do you just, you know, when you see different bugs around, do you ever just go catch them and eat them to see what they're like?
I do. Well, so I live a lot of my life in a very urban setting, and I always recommend to people not to eat urban bugs just because of the human filth and chemicals that they may have come into contact with. But when I get to stay up at my family's house, which is kind of in a very woodsy, natural setting, then, yeah, I mean, I recently went out with a butterfly net and caught, you know, like 10 pretty big grasshoppers in about 10 minutes. And they were fantastic. I mean, I brought them inside. I sauteed them with a little bit of butter and garlic. And what happens is they sort of plump up in the pan and they turn bright red, just like a crawdad would.
And it's perfectly kosher.
And it's perfectly kosher, and they're really good for you, and they taste great.
That's very interesting. I'm going to, you know, I'm really going to have to try some of these. I'm just, you know, the more I talk about it and think about it, the more I really, and for years I've wanted to, but the more I really want to. So let's go into some of these edible species out there. You've mentioned a handful of them. What are some of the other bugs that you recommend eating? And then after that, let's talk about, you know, certain species that you absolutely never want to eat for that.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to touch on what you said just briefly about wanting to try it. And we're talking about taste and whatnot. The thing is also about insects is they're such nutritional powerhouses. I mean, crickets, for instance, they have about half the protein of beef. But they have like 10 times the calcium and 3 times the iron of beef, which is traditionally like the highest source of iron in nature. I mean, you know, when you're anemic or pregnant, the doctor tells you to eat red meat. But you could be getting 3 times the iron with the same amount of food by eating crickets. So there's so many things that we eat for nutritional purposes that don't taste good at all, that it's crazy that we would overlook bugs because they're so sustainable. I mean, like spirulina doesn't taste that great. You know, there's a lot of things you put into a smoothie that you basically choke down because it's good for you, right? And insects are such a great example of that, and they taste good. And they taste good. It's crazy. Even if they tasted awful, they're super sustainable and they're super good for you. So you'd think that people would accept them by that count alone. And the only reason we don't is because we have this really weird cultural association with them. It's crazy. So I'm sorry, what was the...
You know what, we're just talking about which bugs to eat and which ones to stay away from. But before we go there, let's... what cultures eat insects and what cultures do not? You know, and what's funny is, you know, in ethnomycology, we have... mycophiles and mycophobes, right? Where you look at different cultures across the board, and these cultures either they eat mushrooms in large scale, or microphobic cultures, they either completely don't eat them like India, or they only have a couple that they'll typically eat like us. So, you know, is the insect world the same way, where you have cultures that just across the board they eat insects, and then other cultures they completely stay away from it, or how is it?
I think it has to do with availability. I mean, there's a lot of sort of, I mean, you don't really hear about a lot of bugs being eaten in Nordic cultures, or like, you know, very, very cold places where there aren't a lot of bugs. I think there's just...
Are mosquitoes and mosquito larvae just aren't that tasty for those climates when they warm up in the winter or summer?
Well, mosquitoes are a different issue. We're talking about bugs, you know, they are what they eat. People have asked me before if I would eat mosquitoes, and I say no because they've been feeding on other people's blood. Ew. I don't want to ingest that. Yuck ola. So I would say, yeah, the bug girl's grossed out by that, right? I wouldn't eat mosquitoes. But okay. Mosquitoes are fantastic food for birds and dragonflies and other things that I would eat. Which is actually an interesting kind of a progression there that I never thought through.
I'm glad that you have a systematic method to spot your own contradictions. That's good to know.
Yeah, I'm just not too thrilled about the idea of eating mosquitoes, but I guess if I were starving...
Now it looks like you're having to reconsider the whole thought.
Well, you know, you talk about food being translated through different organisms.
We'll have to figure out a way to farm some mosquitoes that are grown on some sort of, I don't know.
I don't think they can. Mosquitoes and other species.
Well, only use the blood when they're breeding? Don't they typically eat plants and other things for the rest of the time? I think I read something somewhere recently that the female mosquitoes drink the blood when they're getting ready to lay eggs.
Oh, interesting. Well, news to me. Again, I'm not an entomologist. I don't claim to be. And I don't think that's bad. I mean, most chefs, for instance, aren't ornithologists, but they cook plenty of chicken. I'm always more interested in the cultural perspective on entomophagy. I wouldn't eat mosquitoes. So, but you talk about, you know, which cultures is it common in and which cultures not. I guess I would say those cultures that are more industrially inclined tend to view insects as being kind of a lower form of nutrition. Although, I mean, you know, you take the Japanese, for instance, and you would almost think, well, you know, they're such a fastidious culture. That's the last thing they would ever eat. And yet, the Japanese absolutely have a tradition of eating insects. So I would say, in general, a lot of Asian cultures, which have a broader view of edibility in general, it seems like,
Absolutely.
We'll include insects. Well, at least from our perspective. I mean, we eat a lot of things that they're like, you know, it was Andrew Zimmern had a fantastic, Andrew Zimmern, host of Bizarre Foods, had a fantastic quote about having talked to an African village who were completely happy to be eating termites. Yet when he mentioned the concept of cheese, in other words, you know, fermented rotted milk, they were horrified.
Well, isn't it in China that they don't eat cheese either, and they're horrified by our concept of cheese as well?
Could be.
Yeah, and I've come across that before as well with regards to cheese. And you think of like kefir, and you know, that kind of stuff, which is rotten milk. And you know, I've had kefir grains, and you just get some good raw milk and you throw it on the counter and you throw these grains in there, and every day it makes you a new batch of rotten milk, and it tastes great.
And it's fermented too. To us, yeah. Because we're not revolted by the idea of it.
Well, actually, the first 2 weeks I was eating it, it was pretty revolting of the idea. And then all of a sudden, one day it started tasting good. And, you know, I had like 3% alcohol or something in there, too. And I wasn't complaining about that, you know.
Well, so why were you eating it if you were revolted by the idea? You're eating it for health reasons, right?
Right.
Okay. So I think that insects could go down the same route. And I think especially if you did it every day for 2 weeks, it would become zero big deal to you.
Well, it's like sushi, you know, because I remember in my early 20s, one day I just said, you know what, I'm going to go try sushi. And I went into a sushi restaurant. It was all you can eat. I gave them like $25. And I went down the line and I grabbed one of everything.
Yeah.
And half of it I gagged on, and the other half was so delicious. I came back the next week and I knew I'm not eating any of those, and these are the ones that I want. And so, you know, it's just about getting familiar with what you like and what you don't, and go do it.
Yeah.
All right. So let's get back into these edible and non-edible species.
Okay. So of the 1 to 3 million known insect species that live on the planet. Now, again, insects are the majority of the biomass on the planet. So the majority of living things on the Earth are bugs. Number one. So that's a lot. That's a lot of different species. Of that, you know, documented million plus, about 1,500 are known, documented, to be edible. There's probably way more than that, but there hasn't been formal documentation on this subject for all that long. So within that 1,500, that's a lot. That's a lot of different species. When you think about the types of meat that you've eaten in your life, you know, you've eaten what? A few different mammals, a dozen different fish, some birds. What? That's 15 different types of animal you've eaten, maybe, for the average person. You know, you
right.
seem like you're adventurous. Yeah. You probably had more. Right.
And for some cultures, even less than that, you know, if they don't eat pork or what have you, you know.
Right.
And shellfish and certain things.
Exactly. So you take 1,500, that's a pretty broad palate of taste. And a lot of those insects are specifically engineered to survive on certain plants alone. So like silkworms, for instance, have to eat mulberry leaves. Tomato hornworms live on tomato plants. That kind of thing.
And those are those great big worms that I used to get when I was a kid off of our tomato plants. So how do those taste? Are those good?
Those are pretty shrimpy. I would say they have a strong shrimpy taste. Some people say they taste like shrimp, like tomato-y shrimp, like green tomatoes crossed with shrimp.
So like a tomatillo shrimp.
Like a tomatillo shrimp. Exactly. Exactly. Which, yeah, I mean, nothing to complain about there, right?
Right.
And they're supposedly really high in calcium. And again, you know, if you can harvest those off your plants, they become a boon rather than a bane. And they're the bane of many tomato growers. So, you know, pretty cool. So, yeah, within those 1,500 species, and, you know, a lot of those, you can eat them at different stages of their life. So, for instance, there's beetles that you can eat the rhino beetle. You can also eat the rhino beetle grub, and they both taste different, and they have different properties. So the rhino beetle itself will have more protein, whereas the grub will have more essential fatty acids. It's really, you know, quite an interesting flavor palette. In terms of bugs you can't eat, oddly enough, well, or interestingly enough, the ones that are flashy and colorful and really, you know, look tasty, those are the ones you definitely don't want to eat. The ones that are advertising to the rest of nature, you know, look at me, I'm loud and proud, those are the ones who don't need camouflage because they either taste bad, have some type of toxin, or are downright poisonous. So ladybugs, for instance, nice bright red, very cute, don't eat them.
Really?
Yes. So the rule is, let's see if I can get this right, red, blue or yellow, leave that fellow.
What about you like yellow jackets though, and wasps and bees? You like those?
Right. Yeah, no, the rule has exceptions.
Okay.
The general rule. Red, blue, or yellow, leave that fellow. Black, green, or brown, swallow it down. So in other words, if the animal has to hide, it's got something to hide. If it's, you know, loud and proud, walk away. So yeah, there are some yellow insects that you would eat. Let's see, what else would you eat that's yellow? So yellow jackets. Yeah, I mean, to some extent you'd eat yellow jackets. You'd probably do better off eating their larvae, which are white.
Right, because you wouldn't want to eat the stingers. I suppose that would hurt.
Right. But again, something else that's yellow would be like a monarch caterpillar. Has those stripes of yellow.
Good to eat or bad?
Not good to eat. Not good to eat.
Even the caterpillar, huh?
Even the caterpillar, yeah. What else? Yellow.
So, wow, that's very interesting. So, you know.
So that helps people kind of decide. But then again, that's not a hard and fast rule. There are some black insects, black widows. There's something called like an oil beetle.
Well, have you tried to eat a black widow though?
Heck no. Why would I do that? Why would I do that? You know, I mean, I might do something. I might, you know, eating insects, people may think is a little extreme, but
well, but what spiders really don't have venom. So therefore, you know, is a black widow. I mean, you know, and really for a black widow to bite you, you have to push down on it. It can't just bite you by holding it in your hand. It has to have downward pressure.
Yes.
So technically, I mean, there's a lot of people that keep black widows as pets, too, for that very reason, because it's all about knowing how to handle them.
How to handle them. Well, furthermore, they say that heat actually denatures the proteins in the venom, thus rendering it ineffective.
Exactly.
Having said that, black widows have such potent venom, you know, that's been responsible for how many deaths over the years. It just doesn't seem like a worthwhile bet. I mean, even if you were starving, isn't there anything else you can eat besides this thing that's loaded with this potent venom? I mean, you'd have to boil it to goodness knows. Why bother? That's what I say.
I guess ask the Japanese about fugu fish
about
at that
fugu.
Point.
About fugu. But a fugu has something where you can slice it away. I mean, black widows, again, they're so tiny. I mean, you know, but I eat tarantulas. Tarantulas have some venom.
Right.
And I eat those. I have people suck the meat out of their fangs. So, you know. But again, there's something to eat there. And the venom is very low, especially in rose-haired tarantulas. They're like the starter spider.
Right.
They're great pets, by the way. They're such fantastic pets. I don't understand why people get goldfish when you can get a tarantula. They're so much more fun to look at. You don't have to clean their tanks. They require next to no care. They're awesome. So much better than goldfish.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah. Goldfish are a lot of work, comparatively.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was thinking about getting some more guinea pigs.
Guinea pigs, again. Again, why aren't we eating more guinea pigs?
Exactly.
Just 'cause they're not, you know, they don't fit in our...
You know, and, you know, it took me about 20 minutes to get over the cultural taboo when I was in Peru, because, you know, in Peru, they serve that stuff everywhere. And you go, typically you have to go the night before and tell the restaurant that you want to have cooey the next day, because they have to kill it and prepare it and everything and get it ready. So, and it tastes so close to chicken, it's ridiculous. But it's just a lot more fat. And you can see that, like I said earlier, you can see that foods like this are very sustainable, very cheap, and very healthy. And, you know, there's so many more ways to do this, to get away from this corporate culture that we're enslaved to right now, and find sources of food that, like insects, that they can't even control.
Exactly. Exactly. So our dream in the entomophagy community is that, you know, people will have these individual in-home bug farms, or, you know, maybe one in their community. And it's this completely independent meat supply.
Daniela, what is the single most important concept that you would like people to take away from this interview?
That's a great question. Oh, boy. Just that it's really dumb not to be eating insects. You know, I mean, a lot of people think, you know, why would you do that? It just seems like such a silly idea. And I'm saying it's silly not to. I mean, with all of the ecological and nutritional and cultural logic behind it, why wouldn't you? It's just stupid. It's just stupid. And, you know, aside from the fact that you're doing it already, not eating insects is dumb. That's my takeaway.
All right. And would you like to give out your websites, any contact information? Are you planning on writing a book about all of this?
I'm looking into it. There are so many people, fascinating people, in this field. Especially right now, we're getting a lot of the younger element. You know, I'm friends with two frat brothers who are raising organic mealworms together. I mean, it's awesome the type of people that are out there right now. So I would love to do some type of book that kind of covers all of that, so that I can give each people their rightful voice, because they're just so, they're all so fascinating, and I think it'd be really neat for people to read about that. So we'll see, maybe. I'm working on it. Something's right. Definitely in the works. Yes. If you want more information,
Oh, I was just going to say, make sure you give everybody your website. You know,
yes.
One thing that I found is when I went to girlmeetsbugs.com, most of the time the website would not come up. I had to go to eddiebug.wordpress.com/listofedibleinsects to get to your website.
Wow, that's crazy. I've never had that problem. The website is www.girlmeetsbug.com, just like girl meets boy. Girl
and
meets
I
bug.
Tried to pull it up this morning, and it was not working when I typed that in. I'll try it right now. Girlmeetsbug.com, right?
Yeah, I don't know what's going on. I checked all my sources. My hosting should be fine. It might be a WordPress issue. It is technically a blog.
Okay, now it's working, and this morning it didn't. How odd is that?
I don't know. When you sent me that email saying it was down, and I checked it, and it was fine from my computer. So anyway, so there's that. I'm on Facebook. I do a lot of my posting, kind of day-to-day posting on Facebook, I would say, and that's just Facebook/GirlMeetsBug. I'm on Twitter, Girl Meets Bug on Twitter. I'm also doing some writing, blogging for the Huffington Post. So if you search my name or Girl Meets Bug or Daniela Martin, on Huffington Post, you'll find my two articles, one on kind of a breakdown of the various tastes of insects, and one that's entitled 5 Ways to Cook a Cricket.
Interesting. And would you like to give out any contact information, or people just go to your website?
Sure, yeah. If you want to contact me, it's girlmeetsbug@gmail.com.
All right, Daniela, thank you so much for your time and for the very fascinating conversation. I really appreciate it.
Well, I really appreciate getting the chance to really kind of stretch out on this category.
Someday they might sting me anyway. They might.